who are the actors in the story of Jonah, and where do they come from? Hello, this is Doug Clark. Welcome to Pro. We continue in this week's Pro broadcast to lay some background for our reading of the story of Jonah by poking around to find out what we can know about the time and locations involved in the account and the people who inhabited the story. How might these contribute to our understanding and appreciation for the book? To help us explore these issues, I have asked Drs. Alden Thompson and Beverly Beam, who teach Old Testament and English, respectively, at Walla Walla College, to be my guests. To both of you, welcome to Probe.
Thank you.
Alden, I think it might be good to start with actually another question. We talked last time about the prophets in the Old Testament, alluded to them fairly quickly, their basic job description. But we do have a number of stories directly relating to prophetic figures. Your work has taken you into the history books of the Old Testament. You've done a lot of comparative work in Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and so on, and so you've bumped into these stories and dealt with them. What kind of figures do we have in these stories? And how might they contribute as we move toward the book of Jonah itself and to the Jonah story? How might they contribute to the background?
Well, the prophets, the prophetic figures, are pretty exciting characters. And there also seems to be a correlation. The worse things were, the more likely are to get prophets. The Northern Kingdom was kind of a basket case when it came to spirituality. But the Lord kept pumping in prophets there. Probably the two most famous ones are Elijah and Elisha. And these guys are wild men. They play around with bears and with lightning. And it's you want to be pretty careful when you're around a prophet. The bears might come and get you, or lightning may strike from heaven, or any kind of exciting thing. So they are messengers from the Lord designed to help God's people wake up to their responsibilities to God and to each other.
There seems to be a fairly significant emphasis, I guess is the word I would use, on speaking the word that God gives, mm-hmm. and only speaking mm-hmm. the word that God gives, which in many ways I think might play into the Jonah account. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jonah only speaks five words in the book, but these seem to be, as Bev, you've noted before, reluctantly given. They're still the word of the Lord. And we have in some of the stories that that you've referred to, Alden, this call to speak only the word of the Lord. However judgmental, however mm-hmm. strong the message or the medicine, it's the word of the Lord. In fact, we've got a couple of passages, I think, of 1 Kings 13 and 1 Kings 22, where speaking the word of the Lord is a life and death matter. So this must have been fairly significant in the world of the prophets.
Well, I think of one story, if you just think about it, where Elijah, uninvited, walks right in before the king and says, "Thus saith the Lord, no rain until I say so." Like, even if we were to imagine we're in a nice, comfortable recording studio working here, but if a prophet were to walk through that door right there and say, "Thus saith the Lord, Doug Clark," my guess is you'd listen. I might even listen.
No, I think that's right. And I wonder if the stories of the prophets, and Jonah is one of them, if the stories of the prophets aren't there to remind people that this is, I don't know, certainly not the only way that God communicates with people, but it's one that mm-hmm. one ought to listen to, sit up carefully, pay attention to.
And in a secondary sense, in a clearly secondary sense, I suppose it reminds all of us that the Lord wants us to be messengers for him. Now, I am very reluctant to draw parallels between the work of the prophets and the work of ordinary believers. In fact, I don't think one should draw direct parallels. But still, the intent of sending a person, instead of the Lord speaking directly with a voice from heaven, bolt of lightning, he goes to a person and says, "I want you to carry this message. It's going to need some special adaptation to get these people to do it, but I'm calling you to do that. Now go." That, I think, is a powerful example for all of us that he wants us, human beings, to carry his message, to help shape it, mold it to other people. Mm-hmm.
Bev, I wanted to ask you a question in the context of Alden's comments. Alden is thinking about the words and the communication and the forcefulness of the prophetic word. You have reminded us in the past about paying attention to little subtleties in the story, to the potential evidence for irony or satire or a subtle allusion to something which carries impact. Do we have in the book of Jonah a kind of a mixing of those two ways to get people's attention?
Well, clearly we've got two voices operating in the book of Judges. We have the voice
in the book of Jonah. You and I are working a lot with Judges.
I'm
that's
sorry.
Right.
In the book of Jonah, we've got the voice of the narrator or the writer who is telling the story. And then we have the voice of Jonah. And the voice of Jonah, of course, is very exclusive, very even his profession of faith. He believes in God, the creator of heavens and the earth, is just spoken very perfunctorily. The voice of Jonah is a different voice than the voice of the narrator. And what we want to do is see through the voice of Jonah to understand what the narrator is telling us that Jonah may not understand.
Now, I don't know if this is the right word to use, but is there... Someone controls this story, and I don't mean in a
right.
Machiavellian way, but I mean
right.
somebody controls what we see
right.
and read. Now, in this book, it's not so much Jonah, is it?
No.
Even as forceful as the five words of Jonah are,
yes.
who controls what
yes.
we are supposed to be paying attention to? How is the inspiration
yes.
for giving the message? How does that happen in this book?
It is the narrator, the one who is writing, who gives himself a narrative voice in telling a story, is telling us the little things to look at, the details, the ironic twists that help us to interpret the question. Because remember, right at the very end of the book, there's going to be a question that is asked to us. Should I not, God says, to Jonah, but also to us, pity Nineveh? And how are we going to answer that question? We can't answer that question until we understand the story of Jonah, which, incidentally, it doesn't seem like Jonah does.
You know, this reminds me, Alden, we need to go back into the history books. We need to go back into Kings, 2 Kings. There are seven verses in 2 Kings 14, verses 23 through 29, which record the history of Jeroboam. Now, this is Jeroboam the second.
Mm-hmm.
Jeroboam the second, you know, he was a king for over 40 years, but he only ends up with seven verses.
Even though the Bible is, well, not the Bible, but there are hints elsewhere that he was probably one of the more successful, one of the wealthier kings up north.
He certainly brought prosperity. Mm-hmm. to the northern kingdom of Israel. In fact, it's that prosperity that gives rise to messages by Amos and Hosea against abuses of that prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. If we were to look at Jeroboam simply historically, we would see a fairly successful king. But in the minds of the Bible historians, he's not. But tucked away in those seven verses is a reference to Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet. Now, what happens in that story?
Well, in this case, if you look in 2 Kings 14, he simply encourages him to expand his borders. He restored the border of Israel. This is talking about Jeroboam 2, as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. So basically, Jonah says, go get him. We want more territory. An expansionist.
Now, that means that Jonah was actually giving a speech against the foreign nation, and the foreign nation here being the Assyrians. Well, now that's interesting, especially when we look at the book, and especially when God says, now go give a message which is not against them but for them. And in the King's passage, Alden, this is a message that gives courage and hope to the northern kingdom of Israel, right? I mean, this is something of positive news.
And it's a very strange one because it already characterizes Jeroboam as one of the bad guys. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from the sins of the first Jeroboam, etc. But then it comes down this amazing conclusion. The Lord saw that the distress of Israel was very bitter. There was no one left, bond or free, no one to help Israel. But the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. So he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam.
The wicked king who only gets 7 verses.
Yeah. But he saved them by this wicked king.
Now, he saves Israel.
Israel.
Mm-hmm. And Jonah is tied to that.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be prepared for some surprises when we now turn to the book of Jonah, where he wants now, where God at least, it appears, wants to save not the Israelites, but the Assyrians?
Well, that raises another question, Doug, and I don't know whether this is the right time or place to deal with it, but when I was a pastor, I had a member of my church said, "Pastor, I don't have any problems with the big things in the Bible, the resurrection, the second coming, but it's the littler things. Now, did Jonah really get swallowed by a whale?" And there is this impulse, I think, in some conservative communities that say it can only be true if it's factual, if it really happened exactly that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the book of Jonah, I think, maybe points in the direction that one can go either way. There are people who go either way. But whether or not it's a historical account, it has a powerful message.
So, does truth have to be factual? Or maybe put another way, for something to be true, does it have to be factual? Help us out here.
You know, the question is the story true? Of course the story is true.
Of course.
And what is the story saying? If the story is saying anything about the anatomy of fish and the oxygen content of fishes' bellies, that's a very strange concept of truth. I guess I would like to think that God can work a miracle that would save Jonah, whatever. It doesn't matter. But what does matter is that the theme of the book of Jonah is that God is the creator of heaven and earth. That is the message of Jonah, and that is true. And that God loves all of his creation, that is what Jonah is teaching, and that is true.
And, of course, if you look at Jesus' parables, you have everything else from parables that have a fairly strong relationship to current reality over on the other side. Nobody asks, at least in his audience, is the story really true? No, they're all true. It's just the historical element may be more or maybe less. So I think we can leave the question, the story of Jonah, wide open and look at the impact of the story.
The basic point.
Sure.
And we get at that by a number of ways, but paying attention to literary things especially.
And that's the whole purpose for telling a story.
Yeah. As we close this discussion, it's interesting to note how our observations about the who, the when, and the where of the Jonah narrative help bring out what we never would have seen otherwise, how it enriches our reading of an amazing story. Thank you, Alden and Bev, for your help. Next week on Probe, Bev and Alden will again be my guests as we continue discussing the story of Jonah, this time on the issue of judgment and the prophet. Please join us then. My thanks to Steve Cochran, the producer of Probe, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Doug Clark.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you may call 509-527-2194 or email probe@wwc.edu. Join us again next week at this same time for Probe.